Lisa Scottolini is one of my favorite guests and one of my favorite writers. She is a New York Times bestselling and Edgar Award-winning author, and her new novel is Damage, the newest in her acclaimed Rosato and D'Annunzio series. In the novel, Mary D'Annunzio, partner at the all-female law firm of Rosato and D'Annunzio, finds herself embroiled in one of her most heartbreaking cases yet. Patrick O'Brien, a 10-year-old boy whose small size and dyslexia make him an easy target for bullies at school, is accused of attacking a school aide. The aide quits and promptly sues the boy, his family, and the Philadelphia School District. Mary takes on the case, becoming Patrick's true champion and his one chance for a stable, secure life, as well as the justice he deserves. The name of the novel is Damaged, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Lisa Scottolini back to the roundtable. Lisa, how are you?
I'm terrific, and thanks so much for having me back.
It's always a lovely, lovely time when we can have you on the program. What brought you to this particular subject in Damaged?
Well, you know what? Briefly, like a lot of women, I have a best friend. And she's been my best friend for 30 years. And what's amazing about her, among many things, is that she is a lawyer, a special education lawyer, which is the kind of lawyer that helps kids who are not getting programming they need in the public school system and in the private school system, actually. And I thought, you know, it's perfect for me because as a novelist, I'm always interested in where law and people's real lives intersect. And sometimes where law doesn't always connect to justice, and you really get to see that up close in special education law. So I said, you know what? That's my new book.
So in this novel, we meet Patrick O'Brien. He's a 10-year-old kid. He's small. He has dyslexia, and he's bullied a lot at school, ultimately accused of attacking a school aide who then quits and sues the child, the family, as well as the school district in the city of Philadelphia.
Right. The usual cauldron of litigation and shortage of public funding and bullying. And I think, you know, not to make light of it, because really what I'd like to do is really throw a spotlight on it. You begin with the notion that was news to me that there can be a 10-year-old who doesn't know how to read, yet is being passed grade after grade. And at the same time, though his dyslexia was identified, kind of ignored. That was news to me that that could happen. And when I did the research, it's obvious that it happens, not only in Philadelphia, where my research is, but I'm sure in every major city. It's all a question of funding and staff, and there's so much cutbacks. And I said, it's truly heartbreaking to see what these kids go through because they're super smart kids. It's just that the way their brain is wired, they can't put sounds to the words, and so they can't learn to read, and you can't learn if you can't read. In fact, the saying they taught me is, first you learn to read, and then you read to learn. Mm. And it's resonant for me as someone who loves reading so much. And I love that expression. I see, you know, it hit home for you, too. And you kind of go, huh, let's write about that. What is it like to be that kid? And, of course, he gets into deep trouble, not his own doing, but he just gets deeper and deeper into it. And I love that a lawyer comes to save the day. As to whether she does in the end, I can't tell you because that's a surprise ending, as you know.
That's right.
But she's going to fight for him. And I also like so much that this aspect of the law, special education law, is the area where you really identify with your clients and get emotionally involved with them. You know, I confess that I was a lawyer in my past.
Right.
And I really was, I identified very much with my clients. I worked very hard for them. And I got emotionally involved with them because that's the kind of girl I am. I mean, in that you really start taking their work home and you're worrying about them. But that is definitely comes with the territory in special education law because you have a kid who is getting assaulted from all sides and not getting any help. And he lives with his grandfather and his champion is his attorney, and I wanted to write about that.
For Mary D'Annunzio, who is the protagonist in your novel, who takes on this case and takes this boy under her wing, what is in it for her in the sense of what is she trying to accomplish?
Well, see, you put it perfectly. She does take him under her wing, and she kind of really takes him to her heart. And I think what she's trying to accomplish at first is to just get him the programming he needs, that there's a specific protocol for dyslexic children, and it works. but the school isn't following it and doesn't have the, can't afford the people to staff it and teach it and the materials to support it. So that's where she starts. But then, as you know, there's a very sad event takes place, and she finds herself with much more than a special education case on her hands. And then she's in, you know, she's in for a penny, in for a pound, because she cares so much about the kid.
A lot of this novel also, you are showing what it's like to be up against a very difficult attorney on the other side, in this case, Nick Machiavelli, so who I believe you refer to as the Dark Prince of South Philly lawyers.
Right. Well, I guess I'd like to write about, there's a couple of different types of lawyers in here. There are protagonists, you know, sort of more heroic, and we admire her. And so the school district lawyers, believe it or not, and the child advocate lawyers, believe it or not, everyone is really trying their best with the resources they have. However, there's a lawyer in this book named Nick Machiavelli, and the surname's intentional. I mean, I looked it up, and believe it up, there are 36 actual descendants of Machiavelli in the country. And
Good to know.
Thought this would be so perfect, because I thought, I really want somebody who is Machiavellian, frankly. And I want to have some fun with it. I think people who read me know that even though I write these thrillers and mysteries that are really twisty, I like to have some humor. And to have a really deliciously nasty person who will stop at nothing to get his own end, even running over the rights and justice for a child, that's a hard-hearted guy. But an interesting, manipulative villain. And God knows there are a few of those in the Bar Association. And so I wanted to sort of write about that.
And is it just all about the winning the case?
Well, interestingly, that's really the question, isn't it? I think for Machiavelli, it's absolutely about winning the case, and there's some kind of ego and narcissism involved. But for Mary, the protagonist, it isn't about that at all. And
sure.
In fact, you know, when these horrifying events take place, she wants to actually adopt the child. It's really for her about doing good and saving a kid. And, you know, I really wanted to shine a spotlight on these public interest lawyers, like special education lawyers and lawyers, all sorts who do a lot of good works in public interest, because they make no money. They get very little attention, but they are really helping people every day. And I think they're kind of heroic. So I wanted to really point that out, because, you know, these kids, especially kids who have special needs, are not going to get the help they need unless there's a lawyer involved who's going to fight for them. It's just how it works. Happily, the law is there, but it takes a lawyer to put it into effect.
You mentioned that this story came from a best friend. Do you have more friends who are writers or more friends who are lawyers?
Oh my God. I have writer friends, but all the writers that I know, and I guess I've been doing this for 25 years, believe it or not, we all are in our little houses and behind our little computers. Nobody socializes. I swear, people, I think the public will tend to think, like, you know, we all go out drinking. Nobody goes out drinking. We all have word counts. I bought a treadmill this year. I have a treadmill desk. If there is a better metaphor for a writer, I don't know one, but, you know, or anybody really, you know, you go to work every day. For me, I try to do 2,000 words. And my friends are my best friend I've had since the first day of law school. All my friends are all my normal friends. I actually am not, I don't socialize that much, but the writers, we all keep in touch maybe by email, if that.
How is the treadmill desk going?
I got to tell you, I'm deeply in love with it. I mean, I was having back problems, and you sit on your butt every day for 2,000 words.
Sure.
Which, right? Some days I get that by 7 o'clock. Other days I don't get it till 11 o'clock. And, for example, on a day like this, it's fun to talk to you, and then I'm going to have to go back to work. And you find that you're sitting all day, and so I've had this thing for about 6 months, and I walk very slowly. It goes 2 miles an hour maximum. I probably have it on, you know, 0.3 miles an hour, just enough to type and think. And instead of sitting for 3 hours or 4 hours at a stretch, I'll have been standing. I like that.
Well, this may seem like an odd question, but do you think it has any impact on your work, on allowing you to perhaps think in a different way?
You know, I think that's an insight. I mean, I absolutely do think that. I think, I'll keep it short, not to bore your listeners, but I really think that I'm doing two novels a year.
Right.
And a nonfiction collection that's kind of humorous, like Irma Bombeck with my daughter.
Right.
And I think that to be writing at your best, but I always think I'm a little bit in training. I make sure I get a good amount of sleep. I eat right. I think moving around us, and as many writers will tell you, I think, you know, when you are in motion or you look away from the computer is when you get, that's what should happen next. That's my twist. That's the next thing this character would do. I agree with you. I do think there's something to motion and being freeing and writing better.
And because it sort of comes to the idea of having the best ideas in the shower. The same kind of thing that you're
That's
you're,
so true.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, that's so true. I know, but if I'm stuck, I'll either walk the dogs or shower, and you know. They're like, "Can you walk us?" I'm like, "No, it's easier to shower." And you know, and that's the whole thing, especially for a book that like this one, you know, you throw a curve in there and it's not that I put the curve in there. It's that the characters do something that they would that is consistent with that character. But we didn't expect. That's why I love writing thrillers in a way, whether you call them thrillers or mysteries or whatever people call them. I just think they're interesting and exciting and page-turnery. But life is a little like that. Like, you didn't know, that person did that? Oh, I didn't realize they were going to do that. And then you start to look back and go, well, now I see why they did that. But you might not have predicted it in advance.
How much do you put yourself into the position of the character? So you say, okay, Mary is taking on and is becoming Patrick's champion. There's these twists. What would I, Lisa, do if I were facing this?
Right, and that's really the key question. And the really Mary D'Annunzio, who I've written about before, although it is a series, but it's very, you don't have to read every one.
Right.
You don't have to study to pick up this one. I hate that idea. Mary's frankly closest to me. I mean, she's more like me. When those pedigree commercials with the dogs, I have five dogs, cats, I want to take care of everything. I want to feed everybody. I don't know if it's being Italian or just being a real soft touch, but she's a soft touch. And I have soft touch like written on my forehead. So I get that. I like that about her, but she runs into problems because of it. I mean, she's about, you know, she's reaching out to maybe adopt this kid who's her client, and this her boyfriend who's about to marry in a day or so is going, oh, slow your roll there, dear. We didn't discuss this. We need to make joint decisions.
Right.
I know you know, like most people, you have to confirm before you bring home a stray cat. You are adopting a child. And that's the kind of trouble that she gets into, and I could see getting into that trouble.
Is it difficult, do you think, and I'm not talking about what's real out there in the world. I'm more talking about what our perceptions as a reading audience is, that there is such a thing as an empathetic attorney.
Absolutely. I think the best attorneys are empathetic. I was a trial lawyer. I did corporate defense. I think to stand up in front of a jury, it's no different than being a novelist, because you're really whether you write fiction or nonfiction, and I write both, you're striving for truth. You really have to say something true, that's true about life, that's true about the character, that somebody will go, oh, that sounds like me, that reminds me of me. And when you are standing, and I think it's all about voice. So when you stand in front of a jury, they can hear when you're lying to them. I'm not a good liar. I don't think anybody really is that good a liar. So you can, if you really listen, you can hear when someone is telling you something really true, or if they're being BS-y. So that is the same skill that a novelist uses and an author uses. And so a truly empathic or empathetic lawyer, you're going to know it. You're going to know it when you meet that person. You're going to know it when you consult that person. And you're going to know it in their actions. I mean, when you look at the complaints that people have about lawyers, one is that they never return my calls. That's the first complaint the American Bar Association has identified, Now, that's not a person who cares about you. If they're not getting back to you, they don't care about you. But of course, you know, the positive exists. It really does. And that's why I want to spotlight it.
Well, you know, and is it, I don't know if this is a weird question or not, but is it?
Go ahead.
I
love talking to you.
When we have the, like, a political climate like we have, and mm-hmm. and there is so much negativity, and apparently mm-hmm. all the rules have been put aside and you can just say whatever the hell you want now. Does that change? I mean, do you see that at all in your writing? I mean, does it impact it in the sense that we seem to be, I don't mean that it changes the story fundamentally, but just the mood that we are kind of in as a whole, as a society and as a culture?
That's a fascinating question. I think, to put it positively, I don't think it's even only the politics. I think it's the internet, that you can write a comment that I would say is raw. It's exactly what you think. It's exactly the way you think it. If you're intelligent, if you sound it. If you're an idiot, you sound it. It's all given equal weight. I actually think that's a good thing because everybody is getting their little words out. However, it has, to a certain extent, certainly altered. I wanted to say lowered, but I think to a certain extent it has altered our discourse across the board. And so what people are doing in the political arena is only a part of that. And so I kind of think it doesn't affect my writing because the truth is I always wrote that way. I mean, I'm trying, right. as I said, I'm trying to write something true. So if there's a lot of exposition, I don't put it in. Like Elmore Leonard famously said, he leaves out the parts that people skip. You know, that's a good suspense thriller writer talking. I'm always trying to keep it real. And so I think I've been doing that for 20 years. I think that's part of the reason the books are successful, because people recognize that. So in a way, I think this is all to the good. I wish that there were more checks by these individuals on what they say, the unkindness, the unfairness, the absolute fact-free atmosphere. It really has to, it's a shame. But you know what's so great? As a lawyer, as a First Amendment fan, the Founding Fathers wanted the counteracting to that is more speech, is correct speech, not censorship, not silence. So if somebody says something dopey or completely fact wrong, in my world, I want people to go, no, that's wrong. Not shout them down, not call them names. Just simply point out why they're incorrect. And so it's a very exciting time we live in, but it's really rich for writers like me, because in fact, you just try to keep up.
Yeah, but I worry about kids like Patrick, kids who are bullied, kids who have a tough time, kids who don't have the same playing field perhaps as everybody else. And how they take to that of what's written in a comment section or how they're bullied or what's said about them. And they need people, in this case, they need people like Mary who takes them and protects them in some way, shape, or form. But it seems like a lot more people need some version of protecting because there's so many people out there who are ready to get them.
Yeah, I think you're really right about that. And I think it shows what a good heart you have that you think that. I think that too. And I feel that. I feel like that's right. There's a level of I can say whatever I want in the world. That's why I think bullying's on the increase. And, you know, one of the teachers that I spoke to, because I love teachers and they really helped me with the research for this book, because there's teachers in this book. And it's all really about the educational system and bullying in it and how you deal with kids who have special needs. And she said to me, you know, in the old days, if a teacher yelled at a kid, the mother would say to the kid, what did you do to that teacher? But if you do it now, the parent will say, what did that teacher do to you? I mean, right? And
yes.
That, when she said to me, I thought that is so true. Some we're still in the newfound stages of our freedom in speech and action. And I don't think we are yet. We're like a kid with a toy. We've got to figure out how to temper it. You know, I wish there were more checks for people. And that's really inappropriate to say. Or bullying is really wrong. And any time you spend in schools, you would be heartened to see, you know, how much anti-bullying curriculum. And certainly with respect to special needs kids and adults. And my hope is that it will really speak to children with special needs and to their parents and to culture at large to understand that differences aren't anything to be ridiculed.
Well, the new book is just fantastic. It's Damaged. It's published by St. Martin's Press, and it's always a pleasure. Lisa Scottolini, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning, and best of luck with the work and the treadmill and the dogs and all of that.
Thank you so much.
Always great to speak with you. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Damaged. It is published by St. Martin's Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.